where he had found them in the past and told me to book a yurt there, adding, "Probably best not to use my name." In the weeks before my trip to Washington State, I pored over Stamets's field guide, hoping to prepare myself for the hunt. It seems there are more than 200 species of psilocybe distributed all over the world. It's not clear whether that's always been the case or if the mushrooms have followed in the footsteps of the animals who have taken such a keen interest in them. Humans have been using psilocybin mushrooms sacramentally for at least 7,000 years, according to Stamets. But animals sometimes ingest them too, for reasons that remain obscure. Psilocybes are saprophytes, living off dead plant matter and dung. They are denizens of disturbed land, popping up most often in the habitats created by ecological catastrophes, such as landslides, floods, storms, and volcanoes. They also prosper in the ecological catastrophes caused by our species, clear-cut forests, road cuts, the wakes of bulldozers, and agriculture. Several species live in and fruit from the manure of ruminants. Curiously, or perhaps not so curiously, the most potent species occur less often in the wild than in cities and towns. Their predilection for habitats disturbed by us has allowed them to travel widely, following streams of debris, Stamets writes, including our own. In recent years, the practice of mulching with wood chips has vastly expanded the range of a handful of potent psilocybes once confined to the Pacific Northwest. They now thrive in all those places we humans now landscape. Suburban gardens, nurseries, city parks, churchyards, highway rest stops, prisons, college campuses, even, as Stamets likes to point out, on the grounds of courthouses and police stations. Psilocybe mushrooms and civilization continue to co-evolve, Stamets writes. So you would think that these mushrooms would be fairly easy to find. In fact, after I published an article about psilocybin research, I was informed by a student that after the December rains, psilocybes can be found on the Berkeley campus where I teach. "Look in the wood chips," he advised. Yet as soon as I began studying the photographs in Stamets's field guide, I began to despair of ever identifying any mushroom as a member of the genus, much less learning how to distinguish one species of psilocybe from another. To judge from the pictures, the genus is just a big bunch of little brown mushrooms, most of them utterly nondescript. By comparison, the edible species with which I was familiar were as distinct as tulips are from roses, poodles from Great Danes. Yes, all the psilocybes have gills, but that isn't much help, because thousands of other mushrooms have gills too. After that, you're trying to sort out a bewildering array of characteristics, not all of which are shared by the class. Some psilocybes have a little nipple-like knob or protrusion on top. It's called an umbo, I learned. Others don't. Some were viscid, slippery or slimy when wet, giving them a shiny appearance. Others were dull and matte gray. Some, like azurescence, were a milky caramel color. Many, but not all, psilocybes sport a pellicle, a condom-like layer of gelatinous material covering the cap that can be peeled off. My fungal vocabulary might be expanding, but my confidence was rapidly collapsing, much like the mushroom that, in the course of a single day, decomposes into an inky puddle. By the time I got to Chapter 4, The Dangers of Mistaken Identification, I was ready to throw in the towel. "Mistakes in mushroom identification can be lethal," Stamets begins, before displaying a photograph in which a psilocybe stuncii is seen growing cheek by jowl with a trio of indistinguishable Galerina autumnalis, an unremarkable little mushroom that, when eaten, quote, "can result in an agonizing death." But while Stamets urges extreme circumspection in amateurs hoping to identify psilocybes, he also equips the mushroom hunter who hasn't been completely discouraged with something he calls the Stametsian rule, a three-pronged test that he sort of assures us can head off death and disaster. "How do I know if a mushroom is a psilocybin-producing species or not?" he writes. "If a gilled mushroom has purplish brown to black spores and the flesh bruises bluish, the mushroom in question is very likely a psilocybin-producing species." This is definitely a big help, though I wouldn't mind something more categorical than "very likely." He then offers a sobering caveat. I know of no exceptions to this rule, he adds, but that doesn't mean there are none. After committing to memory the Stamezian rule, I began picking promising-looking Guild LBMs in my neighbor's yards, on my walk to work, in the parking lot of the bank, and then roughing them up a bit to see if they would turn black and blue. The blue pigment is in fact evidence of oxidized psilocin, one of the two main psychoactive compounds in a psilocybe. The other is psilocybin, which breaks down into psilocin in the body. To determine if the mushroom in question had purplish brown or black spores, I began making spore prints. This involves cutting the cap off a mushroom and placing it gill side down on a piece of white paper, or black paper if you have reason to believe the mushroom has white spores. Within hours, the mushroom cap releases its microscopic spores, which will form a pretty, shadowy pattern on the paper, reminiscent of a lipstick kiss, that you can then try to decide is purplish brown or black or rust-colored, in which case you might have a deadly gallerina on your hands. Certain things are perhaps best learned in person rather than from a book. I decided I should probably wait before making any irreversible decisions until I had spent some time in the company of my mycological Virgil. At the time of my visit, Paul Stamets lived with his partner, Dusty Yao, and their two big dogs, Plato and Sophie, in a sprawling new house on the Little Skookum Inlet that is constructed inside and out of a small forest's worth of the most gorgeous clear Douglas fir and cedar. Like many species of fungi, Stamets has a passionate attachment to trees and wood. I arrived on a Friday. Our reservation at the campsite wasn't until Sunday night, so we had the better part of the weekend to talk psilocybes, eat other kinds of mushrooms, tour the facilities of his company, Fungi Perfecti, and ramble the surrounding woods and shoreline with the dogs before driving south to the Oregon border Sunday morning to hunt azzies. This was the house that mushrooms built, Stamets explained, launching into its story before I had a chance to unpack my bag. It replaced a rickety old farmhouse on the site that, when Stamets moved in, was slowly succumbing to an infestation of carpenter ants. Stamets set about devising a mycological solution to the problem. He knew precisely which species of cordyceps could wipe out the ant colony, but so did the ants. They scrupulously inspect every returning member for cordyceps spores and promptly chew off the head of any ant bearing spores, dumping the body far away from the colony. Stamets outwitted the ant's defense by breeding a mutant cordyceps-like fungus that postpones sporulation. He put some of its mycelium in his daughter's dollhouse bowl, left that on the floor of the kitchen, and during the night watched as a parade of ants carried the mycelium into the nest, having mistaken it for a safe food source. When the fungus eventually sporulated, it was already deep inside the colony, and the ants were done for. The cordyceps colonized their bodies and sent fruiting bodies bursting forth from their heads. It was too late to save the farmhouse, but with the proceeds from the sale of his patent on the fungus, Stamets was able to erect this far grander monument to mycological ingenuity. The house was spacious and comfortable. I had a whole upstairs wing of bedrooms to myself. The living room, where we spent most of a rainy December weekend, had a soaring cathedral ceiling, a big wood-burning fireplace, and, looming over the room from across the way, a 7.5-foot-tall skeleton of a cave bear. A painting of Albert Hofmann hangs over the fireplace. Overhead, beneath the peak, is a massive round stained glass depicting the universality of the mycelial archetype, an intricate tracery of blue lines on a night sky, the lines representing at once mycelium, roots, neurons, the internet, and dark matter. Displayed on the walls heading upstairs from the living room are framed artworks, photographs, and keepsakes, including a diploma signifying the successful completion of one of the Merry Pranksters' acid tests, signed by Ken Kesey and Neil Cassidy. There are several photographs of Dusty posing in old-growth forests with impressive specimens of fungi, and a colorfully grotesque print by Alex Gray, the Dean of American Psychedelic Artists. The print is Gray's interpretation of the so-called stoned ape theory depicting an early, electrified-looking hominid clutching a psilocybe while a cyclone of abstractions flies out of its mouth and forehead. The only reason I could make any sense of the image at all was that a few days earlier I had received an email from Stamets referring to the theory in question. Quote, I want to discuss the high likelihood that the stoned ape theory, first presented by Roland Fisher and then popularized, restated by Terence McKenna, is probably true. Ingestion of psilocybin causing a rapid development of the hominid brain for analytical thinking and societal bonding. Did you know that 23 primates, including humans, consume mushrooms and know how to distinguish good from bad? I did not. But the brief elliptical email nicely prefigured the tenor of my weekend with Stamets as I struggled to absorb a torrent of mycological fact and speculation that, like a rushing river, is impossible to ford without being knocked sideways. The sheer brilliance of Stamets's mushroom's eye view of the world can be dazzling, but after a while, it can also make you feel claustrophobic, as only the true monomaniac or autodidact, and Stamets is both, can do. Everything is connected is ever the subtext with such people. In this case, what connects everything you could possibly think of just happens to be fungal mycelia. I was curious to find out how Stamets came by his mycocentric worldview and what role psilocybin mushrooms in particular might have contributed to it. Stamets grew up in an Ohio town outside Youngstown called Columbiana, the youngest of five children. His father's engineering company went belly up when Paul was a boy, the family going from riches to rags pretty quickly. Dad began to drink heavily, and Paul began looking up to his older brother John as a role model. 5 years his senior, John was an aspiring scientist. He would receive a scholarship to study neurophysiology, who kept an exquisite laboratory in the basement, a realm that was Paul's idea of heaven, but to which John seldom granted his little brother admittance. I thought all houses had laboratories, so whenever I went over to a friend's house, I would ask where the laboratory was. I didn't understand why they would always point me to the bathroom instead, the lavatory. Winning John's approval became a motive force in Paul's life, which perhaps explains the value Stamets places on mainstream scientific recognition of his work. John had died of a heart attack 6 months before my visit, and, as it happened, on the same day Paul received word of his AAAS honor. His death was a loss from which Paul hadn't yet recovered. When Paul was 14, John told him about magic mushrooms, and when he went off to Yale, John left behind a book, Altered States of Consciousness, that made a tremendous impression on Paul. Edited by Charles T. Tart, a psychologist, the book is a doorstop of an anthology of scholarly writings about non-ordinary mental states, covering the spectrum from dreaming and hypnosis to meditation and psychedelics. But the reason the book made such a lasting impression on Stamets had less to do with its contents, provocative as these were, than with the reaction the book elicited in certain adults. My friend Ryan Snyder wanted to borrow it. His parents were really conservative. A week later, when I told him I wanted it back, he stalls and delays. Another week goes by. I ask him again, and he finally confesses what happened. My parents found it, and they burned it. They burned my book? That was a pivotal moment for me. I saw the Snyders as the enemy, trying to suppress the exploration of consciousness. But if this was such powerful information that they felt compelled to destroy it, then this was powerful information I now had to have. So I owe them a debt of gratitude. Stamets went off to Kenyon College, where as a freshman he had what he calls a profound psychedelic experience that set his course in life. As long as he could remember, Stamets had been stymied by a debilitating stutter. This was a huge issue for me, he said. I was always looking down at the ground because I was afraid people would try to speak to me. In fact, one of the reasons I got so good at finding mushrooms was because I was always looking down. One spring afternoon, toward the end of his freshman year, walking alone along the wooded ridgeline above campus, Stamets ate a whole bag of mushrooms, perhaps 10 grams, thinking that was a proper dose. 4 grams is a lot. As the psilocybin was coming on, Stamets spied a particularly beautiful oak tree and decided he would climb it. As I'm climbing the tree, I'm literally getting higher as I'm climbing higher. Just then the sky begins to darken and a thunderstorm lights up the horizon. The wind surges as the storm approaches and the tree begins to sway. I'm getting vertigo, but I can't climb down. I'm too high, so I just wrap my arms around the tree and held on, hugging it tightly. The tree became the axis mundi, rooting me to the earth. This is the tree of life, I thought. It was expanding into the sky and connecting me to the universe, and then it hits me. I'm going to be struck by lightning. Every few seconds, there's another strike, here, then there, all around me. On the verge of enlightenment, I'm going to be electrocuted. This is my destiny. The whole time I'm being washed by warm rains. I'm crying now. There is liquid everywhere. But I also feel one with the universe. And then I say to myself, what are my issues if I survive this? Paul, I said, you're not stupid, but stuttering is holding you back. You can't look women in the eyes. What should I do? Stop stuttering now. That became my mantra. Stop stuttering now. I said it over and over and over. The storm eventually passed. I climbed down from the tree and walked back to my room and went to sleep. That was the most important experience of my life to that point, and here's why. The next morning, I'm walking down the sidewalk, and here comes this girl I was attracted to. She's way beyond my reach. She's walking toward me, and she says, "Good morning, Paul. How are you?" I look at her, and I say, "I'm doing great." I wasn't stuttering, and I have hardly ever stuttered since. And that's when I realized I wanted to look into these mushrooms. In a remarkably short span of time, Stamets made himself into one of the country's leading experts on the genus Psilocybe. In 1978, at the age of 23, he published his first book, Psilocybe Mushrooms and Their Allies. Their allies understood to be us, the animal that had done the most to spread their genes and, as Stamets now saw as his calling, their planetary gospel. Stamets got his mycological education not at Kenyon, which he left after 1 year, but at the Evergreen State College, which in the mid-1970s was a new experimental college in Olympia, Washington, where students could design their own course of independent study. A young professor named Michael Bug, who had a degree in environmental chemistry, agreed to take under his wing Stamets and two other equally promising, mycologically obsessed students, Jeremy Bigwood and Jonathan Ott. Bug was not himself a mycologist by training, but the four of them mastered the subject together with the help of an electron microscope and a DEA license that Bug had somehow secured. Thus armed, the four trained their attention on a genus that the rest of the field generally chose to pass over in uncomfortable silence. Illegal since 1970, psilocybin mushrooms were at the time chiefly of interest to the counterculture as a gentler, more natural alternative to LSD, but very little was known about their habitat, distribution, life cycle, or potency. It was believed that psychedelic mushrooms were native to southern Mexico, where R. Gordon Wasson had discovered them in 1955. By the 1970s, most of the psilocybin in circulation in America was being imported from Latin America or grown domestically from spores of Latin American species, mostly cubensis. The Evergreen Group chalked up several notable accomplishments. They identified and published three new psilocybin species, perfected methods for growing them indoors, and developed techniques for measuring levels of psilocin and psilocybin in mushrooms. But perhaps the group's most important contribution was to shift the focus of attention among people who cared about psilocybes from southern Mexico to the Pacific Northwest. Stamets and his colleagues were finding new species of psilocybin mushrooms all around them and publishing their findings. "You could almost feel the Earth's axis tilting to this corner of the world," Stamets said. "Anywhere you went in the Pacific Northwest," Stamets recalls, "you could see people tracing peculiar patterns through farm fields and lawns, bent over in what he calls the psilocybin stoop." During this period, the Pacific Northwest emerged as a new center of gravity in American psychedelic culture, with the Evergreen State College serving as its de facto intellectual hub and R&D facility. Beginning in 1976, Stamets and his Evergreen colleagues organized a series of now-legendary mushroom conferences, bringing together the leading lights of both the credentialed and the amateur wings of the psychedelic world. And during my first evening at his house, Stamets dug out some VHS tapes of the last of these conferences, held in 1999. The footage had been shot by Les Blank, but as often happened with coverage of such psychedelic gatherings, no one could ever quite get it together to edit the raw footage, so raw it remains. Conference might not do justice to what now appeared on Stamets's television. We watched as several of the attendees, I spotted Dr. Andrew Weil, best known for his books on holistic medicine, the psychedelic chemists Sasha Shulgin and his wife Anne, and the New York Botanical Garden mycologist Gary Linkoff, arrived to great fanfare in a psychedelically painted school bus piloted by Ken Kesey. The bus was called Farther, the successor to Further, the original Merry Prankster bus, evidently no longer roadworthy. The proceedings looked more like a Dionysian revel than a conference, yet there were some serious talks. Jonathan Ott delivered a brilliant lecture on the history of entheogens, a term he helped coin. He traced their use all the way back to the Eleusinian mysteries of the Greeks, through what he called the Pharmacratic Inquisition, when the Spanish conquest suppressed the Mesoamerican mushroom cults, and forward to the entheogenic reformation that has been underway since R. Gordon Wasson's discovery that those cults had survived in Mexico. Along the way, Ott made an offhand reference to the placebo sacraments of the Catholic Eucharist. Then came footage of a big costume ball with lingering close-ups of a giant punch bowl that had been spiked with dozens of different kinds of psychedelic mushrooms. Stamets pointed out several prominent mycologists and ethnobotanists among the revelers, many of them dressed as specific kinds of fungus, Amanita muscaria, button mushrooms, and so on. Stamets himself appeared dressed as a bear. When one is screening raw footage of people in costume tripping on mushrooms and dancing sloppily to a reggae band, a little goes a long way. So after a few minutes, we flicked off the TV. I asked Stamets about earlier iterations of the conference, some of which seemed to have a slightly more interesting ratio of intellectual substance to Dionysian revelry. In 1977, for instance, Stamets had the opportunity to play host to two of his heroes, Albert Hofmann and R. Gordon Wasson, whose 1957 article in Life magazine describing the first psilocybin journey ever taken by a Westerner, his own, helped launch the psychedelic revolution in America. Stamets mentioned that he collected original copies of that issue of Life, which occasionally show up on eBay and at flea markets, and on my way upstairs to bed that night, we stopped in his office so I could have a look at it. The issue was dated May 13, 1957, and Bert Lahr was on the cover, mugging for the camera in a morning suit and a bowler hat. But the most prominent cover line was devoted to Wasson's notorious article, "The Discovery of Mushrooms That Cause Strange Visions." Stamets said I could have a copy, and I took it to bed. From the vantage of today, it's hard to believe that psilocybin was introduced to the West by a vice president of J.P. Morgan in the pages of a mass circulation magazine owned by Henry Luce. Two more establishment characters it would be difficult to dream up. But in 1957, psychedelic drugs had not yet acquired any of the cultural and political stigmas that, a decade later, would weigh on our attitudes toward them. At the time, LSD was not well known outside the small community of medical professionals who regarded it as a potential miracle drug for psychiatric illness and alcohol addiction. As it happened, the Time Life founder and editor-in-chief, Henry Luce, along with his wife, Claire Booth Luce, had personal knowledge of psychedelic drugs, and they shared the enthusiasm of the medical and cultural elites who had embraced them in the 1950s. In 1964, Luce told a gathering of his staff that he and his wife had been taking LSD, quote, under doctor's supervision. Claire Booth Luce recalled that during her first trip in the 1950s, she saw the world, quote, through the eyes of a happy and gifted child. Before 1965, when a moral panic erupted over LSD, Time Life publications were enthusiastic boosters of psychedelics, and Luce took a personal interest in directing his magazine's coverage of them. So when R. Gordon Wasson approached Life magazine with his story, he could not have knocked on a more receptive door. Life gave him a generous contract that, in addition to the princely sum of $8,500, granted him final approval on the editing of his article, as well as the wording of headlines and captions. It specified that Wasson's account include, quote, a description of your own sensations and fantasies under the influence of the mushroom. As I paged through the issue in bed that evening, the world of 1957 seemed like a faraway planet, even though I lived on it, albeit as a 2-year-old. My parents subscribed to Life, so the issue probably sat in the big pile in our den for a stretch of my childhood. Life magazine was a mass medium in 1957, with a circulation of 5.7 million. Seeking the Magic Mushroom, in which, quote, a New York banker goes to Mexico's mountains to participate in the age-old rituals of Indians who chew strange growths that produce visions, opened on a spread with a full-page color photograph of a Mazatec woman turning a mushroom over a smoky fire and goes on for no fewer than 15 pages. The headline is the first known reference to magic mushrooms, a phrase that, it turns out, was coined not by a stoned hippie, but by a Time Life headline writer. We chewed and swallowed these acrid mushrooms, saw visions, and emerged from the experience awestruck, Wasson tells us somewhat breathlessly in the first paragraph. We had come from afar to attend a mushroom rite, but had expected nothing so staggering as the virtuosity of the performing curanderas, or healers, and the astonishing effects of the mushrooms. The photographer and I were the first white men in recorded history to eat the divine mushrooms, which for centuries had been a secret of certain Indian peoples living far from the great world in southern Mexico. Wasson then proceeds to tell the improbable tale of how someone like him, a banker by occupation, would end up eating magic mushrooms in the dirt-floored basement of a thatch-roofed, adobe-walled home in a Oaxacan town so remote it could only be reached by means of an 11-hour trek through the mountains by mule. The story begins in 1927, during Wasson's honeymoon in the Catskills. During an afternoon stroll in the autumn woods, his bride, a Russian physician named Valentina, spotted a patch of wild mushrooms, before which she knelt in poses of adoration. Wasson knew nothing of these putrid, treacherous excrescences, as he describes them, and was alarmed when Valentina proposed to cook them for dinner. He refused to partake. Not long married, Wasson wrote, I thought to wake up the next morning a widower. The couple became curious as to how two cultures could hold such diametrically opposed attitudes toward mushrooms. They soon embarked on a research project to understand the origins of both mycophobia and mycophilia, terms that the Wassons introduced. They concluded that each Indo-European people is by cultural inheritance either mycophobic, for example, the Anglo-Saxons, Celts, and Scandinavians, or mycophilic, the Russians, Catalans, and Slavs, and proposed an explanation for the powerful feelings in both camps. As he writes, was it not probable that long ago, long before the beginnings of written history, our ancestors had worshipped a divine mushroom? This would explain the aura of the supernatural in which all fungi seem to be bathed. The Wassons either dismissed or overlooked a somewhat simpler explanation, that powerful feelings and a cult of mystery could be expected to gather around a plant that, depending on knowledge and context, could either nourish and delight or lead to an agonizing death. The logical next question presented itself to the Wassons. What kind of mushroom was once worshipped, and why? And with that question in hand, they embarked on a 30-year quest to find the divine mushroom. They hoped to obtain evidence for the audacious theory that Wasson had developed and that would occupy him until his death, that the religious impulse in humankind had been first kindled by the visions inspired by a psychoactive mushroom. As a prominent financier, R. Gordon Wasson had the resources and the connections to enlist all manner of experts and scholars in his quest. One of these was the poet Robert Graves, who shared the Wassons' interest in the role of mushrooms in history and in the common origins of the world's myths and religions. In 1952, Graves sent Wasson a clipping from a pharmaceutical journal that made reference to a psychoactive mushroom used by 16th century Mesoamerican Indians. The article was based on research done in Central America by Richard Evans Schultes, a Harvard ethnobotanist who studied the uses of psychoactive plants and fungi by indigenous cultures. Schultes was a revered professor whom students recall shooting blowguns in class and keeping a basket of peyote buttons outside his Harvard office. He trained a generation of American ethnobotanists, including Wade Davis, Mark Plotkin, Michael Balick, Tim Plowman, and Andrew Weil. Along with Wasson, Schultes is one of a handful of figures whose role in bringing psychedelics to the West has gone underappreciated. Indeed, some of the first seeds of that movement have quite literally sat in the Harvard herbarium since the 1930s, more than a quarter century before Timothy Leary set foot on the campus. For it was Schultes who first identified Tiahuanacatl, the sacred mushroom of the Aztecs, and their descendants, as well as Olaluki, the seeds of the morning glory, which the Aztecs also consume sacramentally and which contain an alkaloid closely related to LSD. Up to this point, the Wassons had been looking toward Asia for their divine mushroom. Schultes reoriented their quest, pointing them toward the Americas, where there were scattered reports from missionaries and anthropologists suggesting that an ancient mushroom cult might yet survive in the remote mountain villages of southern Mexico. In 1953, Wasson made the first of 10 trips to Mexico and Central America, several of them to the village of Huatla de Jimenez, deep in the mountains of Oaxaca, where one of his informants, a missionary, had told him healers were using mushrooms. At first, the locals were tight-lipped. Some told Wasson they had never heard of the mushrooms, or that they were no longer used, or that the practice survived only in some other distant village. Their reticence was not surprising. The sacramental use of psychoactive mushrooms had been kept secret from Westerners for 400 years, since shortly after the Spanish conquest, when it was driven underground. The best accounts we have of the practice is that of the Spanish missionary priest, Bernardino de Sahagún, who in the 16th century described the use of mushrooms in an Aztec religious observance. These they ate before dawn with honey, and they also drank cacao before dawn. The mushrooms they ate with honey, when they began to get heated from them, they began to dance, and some sang, and some wept. Some cared not to sing, but would sit down in their rooms and stayed there, pensive-like. And some saw in a vision that they were dying, and they wept. And others saw in a vision that some wild beast was eating them. Others saw in a vision that they were taking captives in war. Others saw in a vision that they were to commit adultery and that their heads were to be bashed in therefore. Then, when the drunkenness of the mushrooms had passed, they spoke one with another about the visions they had seen. The Spanish sought to crush the mushroom cults, viewing them, rightly, as a mortal threat to the authority of the church. One of the first priests Cortes brought to Mexico to Christianize the Aztecs declared that the mushrooms were the flesh of, quote, the devil that they worshipped, and with this bitter food they received their cruel god in communion. Indians were interrogated and tortured into confessing the practice, and mushroom stones, many of them foot-tall, chiseled basalt sculptures of the sacred fungi, presumably used in religious ceremonies, were smashed. The Inquisition would bring dozens of charges against Native Americans for crimes involving both peyote and psilocybin in what amounted to an early battle in the war on drugs, or to be more precise, the war on certain plants and fungi. In 1620, the Roman Catholic Church declared that the use of plants for divination was, quote, an act of superstition condemned as opposed to the purity and integrity of our holy Catholic faith. It's not hard to see why the church would have reacted so violently to the sacramental use of mushrooms. The Nahuatl word for the mushrooms, flesh of the gods, must have sounded to Spanish ears like a direct challenge to the Christian sacrament, which of course was also understood to be the flesh of the gods, or rather of the one god. Yet the mushroom sacrament enjoyed an undeniable advantage over the Christian version. It took an act of faith to believe that eating the bread and wine of the Eucharist gave the worshiper access to the divine, an access that had to be mediated by a priest and the church liturgy. Compare that with the Aztec sacrament, a psychoactive mushroom that granted anyone who ate it direct, unmediated access to the divine, to visions of another world, a realm of the gods. So who had the more powerful sacrament? As a Mazatec Indian told Wasson, the mushrooms, quote, carry you there where God is. The Roman Catholic Church might have been the first institution to fully recognize the threat to its authority posed by a psychedelic plant, but but it certainly wouldn't be the last. On the night of June 29 to 30th, 1955, R. Gordon Wasson experienced the sacred mushrooms firsthand. On his third trip to Huautla, he had persuaded Maria Sabina, a 61-year-old Mazatec and a respected curandera in the village, to let him and his photographer not only observe, but take part in a ceremony in which no outsider had ever participated. The velada, as the ceremony was called, took place after dark in the basement of the home of a local official Wasson had enlisted in his cause, before a simple altar adorned with Christian images. To protect her identity, Wasson called Sabina Eva Mendez, discerning, quote, a spirituality in her expression that struck us at once. After cleaning the mushrooms and passing them through the purifying smoke of incense, Sabina handed Wasson a cup containing 6 pairs of mushrooms. She called them the little children. They tasted awful, acrid, with a rancid odor that repeated itself, Wasson wrote. Even so, I could not have been happier. This was the culmination of 6 years of pursuit. The visions that now arrived, quote, were in vivid color, always harmonious. They began with art motifs, angular such as might decorate carpets or textiles or wallpaper. Then they evolved into palaces with courts, arcades, gardens, resplendent palaces all laid over with semi-precious stone. Then I saw a mythological beast drawing a regal chariot, and so forth. Wasson's original field notebooks are in the Botanical Library at Harvard. In a neat but somewhat idiosyncratic hand, he kept meticulous track of the time that night, from arrival, 8:15, to ingestion, 10:40, to the snuffing out of the last candle, 10:45. After that, the handwriting disintegrates. Some sentences now appear upside down, and Wasson's descriptions of what he felt and saw gradually break into fragments. Nausea as vision distorted, touching wall, made the world of visions seem to crumble. Light from above door and below. Moon. Table took new forms. Creatures. Great processional vehicle. Architectural patterns of radiant color. Nausea. No photos once the, illegible, seized us. Architectural. Eyes out of focus. The candles, we saw them double. Oriental splendor. Alhambra. Chariot. Table transformed. Contrast. Vision and reality. I touch wall. The visions were not blurred or uncertain, he writes. Indeed, they seemed more real to me than anything I had ever seen with my own eyes. At this point, the reader begins to feel the literary hand of Aldous Huxley exerting a certain pressure on both Wasson's prose and his perceptions. I felt that I was now seeing plain, whereas ordinary vision gives us an imperfect view. Wasson's own doors of perception had been flung wide open. I was seeing the archetypes, the platonic ideas that underlie the imperfect images of everyday life. To read Wasson is to feel as if you were witnessing the still fresh and malleable conventions of the psychedelic narrative gradually solidifying before your eyes. Whether Aldous Huxley invented these tropes or was merely their stenographer is hard to say, but they would inform the genre as well as the experience from here on. For the first time, the word ecstasy took on real meaning, Wasson recalls. For the first time, it did not mean someone else's state of mind. Wasson concluded from his experience that his working hypothesis about the roots of the religious experience in psychoactive fungi had been vindicated. Quote, in man's evolutionary past, there must have come a moment in time when he discovered the secret of the hallucinatory mushrooms. Their effect on him, as I see it, could only have been profound, a detonator to new ideas. For the mushrooms revealed to him worlds beyond the horizons known to him in space and time, even worlds on a different plane of being, a heaven and perhaps a hell. One is emboldened to the point of asking whether they may not have planted in primitive man the very idea of a god. Whatever one thinks about this idea, it's worth pointing out that Wasson came to Huautla with it already firmly planted, and he was willing to subtly twist various elements of his experience there in order to confirm it. As much as he wants us to see Maria Sabina as a religious figure, and her ceremony as a form of what he calls Holy Communion, she saw herself quite differently. The mushroom might well have served as a sacrament 500 years earlier, but by 1955, many Mazatecs had become devout Catholics, and they now used mushrooms not for worship, but for healing and divination, to locate missing people and important items. Wasson knew this perfectly well, which is why he employed the ruse he did to gain access to his ceremony. He told Maria Sabina he was worried about his son back home and wanted information about his whereabouts and well-being. Spookily enough, he received what he discovered on his return to New York to be accurate information on both counts. Wasson was distorting a complex indigenous practice in order to fit a preconceived theory and conflating the historical significance of that practice with its contemporary meaning. As Sabina told an interviewer some years later, "Before Wasson, nobody took the mushrooms only to find God," she said. "They were always taken for the sick to get well." As one of Wasson's harsher critics, the English writer Andy Letcher, acidly put it, "To find God, Sabina, like all good Catholics, went to Mass." Wasson's article in Life was read by millions of people, including a psychology professor on his way to Harvard named Timothy Leary. Wasson's story reached tens of millions more when he shared it on the popular CBS News program, Person to Person, and in the months to follow, several other magazines, including True, the man's magazine, ran first-person accounts of magic mushroom journeys. "The vegetable that drives men mad," went one headline, journeys for which Wasson supplied the mushrooms. He had brought back a supply and would conduct ceremonies in his Manhattan apartment. An exhibition on magic mushrooms soon followed at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Shortly after the article in Life was published, Wasson arranged to have some specimens of the Mexican mushrooms sent to Albert Hofmann in Switzerland for analysis. In 1958, Hofmann isolated and named the two psychoactive compounds, psilocybin and psilocin, and developed the synthetic version of psilocybin used in the current research. Hofmann also experimented with the mushrooms himself. 30 minutes after my taking the mushrooms," he wrote, "the exterior world began to undergo a strange transformation. Everything assumed a Mexican character." In 1962, Hofmann joined Wasson on one of his return trips to Huautla, during which the chemist gave Maria Sabina psilocybin in pill form. She took two of the pills and declared they did indeed contain the spirit of the mushroom. On another return trip, Wasson was joined by James Moore, who had introduced himself as a chemist for a pharmaceutical company. But Moore was really a CIA agent eager to obtain psilocybin for the agency's own psychedelic research program, MKUltra. It didn't take long for thousands of other people, including eventually celebrities such as Bob Dylan, John Lennon, and Mick Jagger, to find their way to Huautla and to Maria Sabina's door. Wasson was half-hearted in his desire to protect Maria Sabina's identity. The same week that the Life article appeared, he self-published a book, Mushrooms, Russia, and History, in which he retold her story but neglected to disguise her name. For Maria Sabina and her village, the attention was ruinous. Wasson would later hold himself responsible for unleashing on lovely Huautla a torrent of commercial exploitation of the vilest kind, as he wrote in a plaintive 1970 New York Times op-ed. Huautla had become first a beatnik, then a hippie mecca, and the sacred mushrooms, once a closely guarded secret, were now being sold openly on the street. Maria Sabina's neighbors blamed her for what was happening to their village. Her home was burned down, and she was briefly jailed. Nearing the end of her life, she had nothing but regret for having shared the divine mushrooms with R. Gordon Wasson and, in turn, the world. "From the moment the foreigners arrived," she told a visitor, "the saint children lost their purity. They lost their force. The foreigners spoiled them. From now on, they won't be any good." When, the next morning, I came downstairs, Paul Stamets was in the living room arranging his collection of mushroom stones on the coffee table. I had read about these artifacts, but had never seen or held one, and they were impressive objects, roughly carved chunks of basalt in a variety of sizes and shapes. Some were simple and looked like gigantic mushrooms. Others had a tripod or four-footed base, and still others had a figure carved into the stipe or stem. Thousands of these stones were smashed by the Spanish, but 200 are known to survive, and Stamets owns 16 of them. Most of the surviving stones have been found in the Guatemalan highlands, often when farmers are plowing their fields. Some have been dated to at least 1000 BC. As Stamets carried the heavy stones one by one from their cabinet to the coffee table, where he arranged them with great care, he looked like an altar boy, handling them with the sobriety appropriate to irreplaceable sacred objects. It occurred to me Paul Stamets is R. Gordon Wasson's rightful heir. Wasson, too, collected mushroom stones, some of which I saw at Harvard. He shares his radically mycocentric cosmology and sees evidence wherever he looks for the centrality of psychoactive mushrooms in culture, religion, and nature. Stamets's laptop is crammed with images of psilocybes, taken not only from nature, he's a superb photographer, but also from cave paintings, North African petroglyphs, medieval church architecture, and Islamic designs, some of which recall the forms of mushrooms or, with their fractal geometric patternings, mushroom experiences. I confess that, try as I might, I often failed to find the mushrooms lurking in the pictures. No doubt the mushrooms themselves could help. This brings us to Terence McKenna's stoned ape theory, the epitome of all mycocentric speculation, which Stamets had wanted to make sure we discussed. Though reading is no substitute for hearing McKenna expound his thesis, and you can find him on YouTube, he summarizes it in Food of the Gods. Psilocybes gave our hominid ancestors access to realms of supernatural power, he writes, catalyzed the emergence of human self-reflection, and brought us out of the animal mind and into the world of articulated speech and imagination. This last hypothesis about the invention of language turns on the concept of synesthesia, the conflation of the senses that psychedelics are known to induce. Under the influence of psilocybin, numbers can take on colors, colors attached to sounds, and so on. Language, he contends, represents a special case of synesthesia in which otherwise meaningless sounds become linked to concepts. Hence the stoned ape. By giving us the gifts of language and self-reflection, psilocybin mushrooms made us who we are, transforming our primate ancestors into Homo sapiens. The stoned ape theory is not really susceptible to proof or disproof. The consumption of mushrooms by early hominids would be unlikely to leave any trace in the fossil record because the mushrooms are soft tissue and can be eaten fresh, requiring no special tools or processing methods that might have survived. McKenna never really explains how the consumption of psychoactive mushrooms could have influenced biological evolution, that is, selected for changes at the level of the genome. It would have been easier for him to make an argument for psychoactive fungi's influence on cultural evolution, such as the one Wasson made. But evidently the fungi had more ambitious plans for the mind of Terence McKenna, and Terence McKenna was more than happy to oblige. Stamets became good friends with McKenna during the last few years of his life, and ever since McKenna's death, at age 53 from brain cancer, he has been carrying the stoned ape's torch, recounting McKenna's theory in many of his talks. Stamets acknowledges the challenges of ever proving it to anyone's satisfaction, yet deems it more likely than not that psilocybin was pivotal in human evolution. What is it about these mushrooms, I wondered, and the experience they sponsor in the minds of men that fires this kind of intellectual extravagance and conviction? The stories of mycoevangelists like McKenna read like conversion narratives in which certain people who have felt the power of these mushrooms firsthand emerge from the experience convinced that these fungi are prime movers, gods of a sort, that can explain everything. Their prophetic mission in life becomes clear. Bring this news to the world. Now consider all this from the mushrooms' point of view. What might have started as a biochemical accident has turned into an ingenious strategy for enlarging the species' range and number by winning the fervent devotion of an animal as ingenious and well-traveled and well-spoken as Homo sapiens. In McKenna's vision, it is the mushroom itself that helped form precisely the kind of mind, endowed with the tools of language and fired by imagination, that could best advance its interests. How diabolically brilliant! No wonder Paul Stamets is convinced of their intelligence. The next morning, before we packed up the cars for our trip south, Stamets had another gift he wanted to give me. We were in his office, looking at some images on his computer, when he pulled off the shelf a small pile of Amadou hats. See if one of these fits you. Most of the mushroom hats were too big for me, but I found one that sat comfortably on my head and thanked him for the gift. The hat was surprisingly soft and almost weightless, but I felt a little silly with a mushroom on my head, so I carefully packed it in my luggage. Early Sunday morning, we drove west toward the Pacific coast and then south to the Columbia River, stopping for lunch and camping provisions in the resort town of Long Beach. This being the first week of December, the town was pretty well buttoned up and sleepy. Stamets requested that I not publish the exact location where we went hunting for Psilocybe azarescens. But what I can say is that there are three public parks bordering the wide open mouth of the Columbia, Fort Stevens, Cape Disappointment, and the Lewis and Clark National Historical Park, and we stayed at one of them. Stamets, who has been coming here to hunt Azzies for years, was mildly paranoid about being recognized by a ranger, so he stayed in the car while I checked in at the office and picked up a map giving directions to our yurt. As soon as we unloaded and stowed our gear, we laced up our boots and headed out to look for mushrooms, which really just means walking around with eyes cast downward, tracing desultory patterns through the scrub along the sand dunes and in the grassy areas adjoining the yurts. We adopted the posture of the psilocybin stoop, except that we raised our heads every time we heard a car coming. Foraging mushrooms is prohibited in most state parks, and being in possession of psilocybin mushrooms is both a state and federal crime. The weather was overcast in the high 40s, balmy for this far north on the Pacific coast in December when it can be cold, wet, and stormy. We pretty much had the whole park to ourselves. It was a stunning, desolate landscape with pine trees pruned low and angular by the winds coming off the ocean, endless, dead flat sandy beaches with plenty of driftwood, and giant storm-tossed timbers washed up and jackstrawed here and there along the beach. These logs had somehow slipped out from under the thumb of the lumber industry, floating down the Columbia from the old-growth forests hundreds of miles upriver and washing up here. Stamets suspects that Psilocybe azarescens might originally have ridden out of the forest in the flesh of those logs and found its way here to the mouth of the Columbia, thus far the only place the species has ever been found. Some mycelium will actually insinuate itself into the grain of trees, taking up residence and forming a symbiotic relationship with the tree. Stamets believes that mycelium functions as a kind of immune system for its arboreal host, secreting antibacterial, antiviral, and insecticidal compounds that protect the tree from diseases and pests in exchange for nourishment and habitat. As we walked in widening spirals and figure eights over the grassy dunes, Stamets kept up a steady mycological patter. One nice thing about hunting mushrooms is that you don't have to worry about scaring them away with the sound of your voice. Every now and then he paused to show me a mushroom. Little brown mushrooms are notoriously difficult to identify, but Stamets almost always had its Latin binomial and a few interesting facts about it at his fingertips. At one point, he handed me a Russula, explaining it was good to eat. I only nibbled at the ruddy cap before I had to spit it out. It was so fiery. Evidently, offering newbies this particular Russula is an old mycological hazing ritual. I saw plenty of LBMs that might or might not be psilocybin and was constantly interrupting Stamets for another ID. And every time, he had to prick my bubble of hope that I had at last found the precious quarry. After an hour or two of fruitless searching, Stamets wondered aloud if maybe we had come too late for the Azzies. And then, all of a sudden, in an excited stage whisper, he called out, "Got one!" I raced over, asking him to leave the mushroom in place so I could see where and how it grew. This would, I hoped, allow me to get my eyes on, as mushroom hunters like to say. Once we register on our retinas the visual pattern of the object we're searching for, it's much more likely to pop out of the visual field. In fact, the technical name for this phenomenon is the pop-out effect. It was a handsome little mushroom with a smooth, slightly glossy, caramel-colored cap. Stamets let me pick it. It had a surprisingly tenacious grip, and when it came out of the ground, it brought with it some leaf litter, soil, and a little knot of bright white mycelium. "Bruise the stipe a bit," Stamets suggested. I did, and within minutes, a blue tinge appeared where I'd rubbed it. That's the psilocin. I never expected to actually see the chemical I had read so much about. The mushroom had been growing a stone's throw from our yurt, right on the edge of a parking spot. Stamets says that, like many psilocybin species, Azzies are organisms of the ecological edge. Look at where we are, at the edge of the continent, the edge of an ecosystem, the edge of civilization, and of course these mushrooms bring us to the edge of consciousness. At this point, Stamets, who when it comes to mushrooms is one serious dude, made the first joke I had ever heard him make. You know, one of the best indicator species for psilocybe azarescens are Winnebagos. We're obviously not the first people to hunt for Azzies in this park, and anyone who picks a mushroom trails an invisible cloud of its spore behind him. This, he believes, is the origin of the idea of fairy dust. At the end of many of those trails is apt to be a campsite, a car, or a Winnebago. We found 7 Azzies that afternoon, though by we I mean Stamets. I only found 1, and even then I wasn't at all certain it was a psilocybe until Stamets gave me a smile and a thumbs up. I could swear it looked exactly like half a dozen other species I was finding. Stamets patiently tutored me in mushroom morphology, and by the following day my luck had improved, and I found 4 little caramel beauties on my own. Not much of a haul, but then Stamets had said that even just one of these mushrooms could underwrite a major psychic expedition. That evening, we carefully laid out our 7 mushrooms on a paper towel and photographed them before putting them in front of the yurt's space heater to dry. Within hours, the hot air had transformed a mushroom that was unimpressive to begin with into a tiny, shriveled, gray-blue scrap it would be easier to overlook. The idea that something so unprepossessing could have such consequence was hard to credit. I had been looking forward to trying an Azzie, but before the evening was over, Stamets had dampened my enthusiasm. "I find azurescence almost too strong," he told me when we were standing around the fire pit outside our yurt having a beer. After nightfall, we had driven out onto the beach to hunt for razor clams by headlight. Now we were sautéing them with onions over the fire. "And Azzies have one potential side effect that some people find troubling," he said. "Yes?" "Temporary paralysis," he said matter-of-factly. He explained that some people on Azzies find they can't move their muscles for a period of time. "That might be tolerable if you're in a safe place," he suggested. "But what if you're outdoors and the weather turns cold and wet? You could die of hypothermia." Not much of an advertisement for azarescence, especially coming from the man who discovered the species and named it. I was suddenly in much less of a hurry to try one. The question I kept returning to that weekend is this. Why in the world would a fungus go to the trouble of producing a chemical compound that has such a radical effect on the minds of the animals that eat it? What, if anything, did this peculiar chemical do for the mushroom? One could construct a quasi-mystical explanation for this phenomenon, as Stamets and McKenna have done. Both suggest that neurochemistry is the language in which nature communicates with us, and it's trying to tell us something important by way of psilocybin. But this strikes me as more of a poetic conceit than a scientific theory. The best answer I've managed to find arrived a few weeks later, courtesy of Paul Stamets' professor at Evergreen State, Michael Bug, the chemist. When I reached him by phone at his home in the Columbia River Gorge, 160 miles upriver of our campsite, Bug said he was retired from teaching and hadn't spent much time thinking about psilocybes recently, but he was intrigued by my question. I asked him if there is reason to believe that psilocybin is a defense chemical for the mushroom. Defense against pests and diseases is the most common function of the so-called secondary metabolites produced in plants. Curiously, many plant toxins don't directly kill pests, but often act as psychostimulants as well as poisons, which is why we use many of them as drugs to alter consciousness. Why wouldn't plants just kill their predators outright? Perhaps because that would quickly select for resistance, whereas messing with its neurotransmitter networks can distract the predator, or better still, lead it to engage in risky behaviors likely to shorten its life. Think of an inebriated insect behaving in a way that attracts the attention of a hungry bird. But Bug pointed out that if psilocybin were a defense chemical, quote, "my former student Paul Stamets would have jumped on it long ago and found a use for it as an antifungal, antibacterial, or insecticide." In fact, Bug has tested fungi for psilocybin and psilocin levels and found that they occur only in minute quantities in the mycelium, the part of the organism most likely to be well defended. Quote, instead, the chemicals are in the fruiting bodies, sometimes at over 2% by dry weight, a stupendous quantity, and in a part of the organism it is not a priority to defend. Even if psilocybin in mushrooms began as, quote, an accident of a metabolic pathway, the fact that it wasn't discarded during the course of the species' evolution suggests it must have offered some benefit. My best guess, Buick says, is that the mushrooms that produced the most psilocybin got selectively eaten, and so their spores got more widely disseminated. Eaten by whom or what and why?